super excited today to talk to Mike McShane of EdChoice and Rick Hess of the American Enterprise Institute. You guys have a new book out that you wrote together. I'm going to just say the name of it first. Getting Education Right, Conservative Vision for Improving Early Childhood K-12 and College. Just a quick question. When I saw the title, I got a little nervous. It's got the word conservative in it. Sounds like you're trying to make education move to the right. Yes? I mean, it's kind of a bold move.
Guilty. Yeah, I would say guilty as charged.
Well, we've all been around this space for a really long time. And this is a major point of your book. So this isn't my idea, but I completely agree. It's always been the case that folks who push to reform education, who push for ideas like school choice and things like that, we have to tiptoe. We have to get everything just right. We have to make sure we have all of our citations in order. We haven't screwed anything up because we have the burden of proof on our side, right? I feel like the folks who've been running education for 100 years are just like, they don't know what they're talking about. So we have to really, really sound like we know what we're talking about. And lots of times we don't want to be like putting it out there that we're trying to put together a conservative agenda, but you boldly went for it.
Yeah, no, I think Rick has made this point, which I think is the smart one, which was, you know, I think a lot of the stuff that we have in the book maybe a sort of small C conservative, a lot of it we think of as just kind of common sense.
Right.
You know, if you look at some of the polling on the stuff that we're talking about, we're on the like 70-30 or 80-20 side of issues, but lots and lots of books get written about education every year. And we can't necessarily expect people to sift through all of them for the nuggets of wisdom that we have or than what we are trying to put forward. So putting a signpost in the title that says, hey, listen, if you are a conservative legislator, if you are a school board member, if you're working for a governor's staff or something, that hopefully will kind of rise to the top and say, oh, I should check this out. That'll make this sort of stand out between all of the other books that come out on education. But we hope, and we've been lucky, you know, if you we were talking just before this about some of the blurbs that were on there. We've been getting really great feedback from people well on to the left side of the spectrum, people to the very far of the left. They may not see a ton that they love in there, but I think we're in a nice sweet spot where people on the right, the center right, and even tipping into the center and center left will find a lot that they could that'll resonate with them.
Yeah, I mean, we have a thing going on in Missouri right now, even as we speak, probably today, yesterday, a bill that's got a lot of school choice in it, got expansion of charter schools. It's got a dramatic expansion of the eligibility for our ESA program, though not funding it. And it is, word on the street is, we're going to have to raise teacher pay to make it happen. And I feel like we put that word was put out on the street kind of a couple of weeks ago, which is like, we started bargaining from the 50-yard line. It's like, we gave it up already. And it's like, are you sure? But it seems like that's going to be the case. And I feel like we often take those kinds of concessions.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, Mike and I wrote the book in part because one of our eternal frustrations is that it's much clearer what conservatives are for than are against than what we're for. We spend an enormous amount of time in education trying to push back on just goofy, nutty stuff coming out of ed schools and unions and, you know, and leftist advocacy groups. But once you get past school choice and maybe free speech on campus, it's not always clear what conservatives are for.
Yeah.
And for us, a big part of the confusion is by conservative, we don't mean Republican. We don't mean that you like Donald Trump. For us, conservatism is about a set of precepts that we tend to believe that hard work is a good thing. We believe that families ought to be at the center of a child's life. We are nervous about bureaucracies and grand schemes to fix the world. We believe in the value of healthy competition. We think it's a good thing. So for us, what we're trying to do is sketch a way that conservatives, whatever your partisan label, whether you're a Republican or an independent or Democrat, a way that people who share some of these core beliefs can actually step forward and say, oh, here's how we can tackle challenges in early childhood. Here's what we should be doing in K-12 other than just embracing school choice. We don't want anybody to ease up on efforts to empower families. We talk in the we're four square behind those. I mean, for heaven's sake, Mike's at EdChoice. But we think if that's the whole agenda, A, you're not solving problems for a lot of real families and kids and educators. And B, you wind up with what you just talked about, you wind up negotiating against yourself. There should be a conservative vision. If we're going to put more money into compensating educators, which I am cool with, well, then we should do it in a way that's good and smart and principled, rather than a sweetener where we spend hundreds of millions of dollars because it's the only way we can get something else that we care about.
Right. So getting into that, you have this nice little history of how we got to where we are, which was very interesting to read. I don't think people quite understand it. And I think that how we kind of led up and through the accountability movement, even the, you know, given that you start with the Nation at Risk, which came out in 1983, and sort of just do the last 40 years. I still feel like in the last 3 to 5 years with the pandemic and everything, we have gotten to a place that is crazier than I expected us to get to, both K-12 and higher ed. I really am shocked that I'm shocked, right? I'm like, are you kidding? Like, some of the stuff that I see has gotten so far afield from where I thought it would be. Do you feel the same? I mean, is there a whole, like, we just need to bring things back a little bit?
That's a good one. That's actually a really good question, because I think that, like, look, part of it, it's tough to separate out from things like social media and others just becoming more ubiquitous. And so, I mean, I think it's maybe possible. There's 14,000 school districts and 100,000 public schools and 3.5 million teachers. And just kind of like the law of large numbers would tell us that at any given moment, something insane is happening somewhere, you know, probably as we're talking right now, someone is doing something wild. And if someone snaps a picture or a video of it, it could go viral tomorrow. So, I mean, I think that's definitely possible. But yeah, and I think, look, a lot of the trends that we identify, maybe the pandemic was like the exclamation point on the end of them. But I think a lot of the stuff that we were seeing in K-12, a lot of stuff we were seeing in higher ed, some of the problems that were happening in early childhood, the train was coming down the tracks, right? Like we've seen where this was going. We see where teacher preparation has been. We've seen where kind of the large lobbying groups in these various areas are. So, I mean, I think the train was kind of coming down the tracks, and maybe the pandemic was kind of the exclamation point that put it into more of our consciousness.
I mean, the congressional hearings on the presidents of the various universities and the things that they wouldn't say, I was like, what happened? I don't want to get into that specifically, but it just seems like, you know, we were talking about kind of, you know, bread and butter things, whole language phonics and stuff, and all of a sudden we're into like, can a teacher change a child's name? And just stuff that seems so far outside the realm of good K-12 policy. So a lot of what I like about your book is it kind of brings it back to like, let's think about a smart agenda here and figure out what are the steps to start putting that in place. Because right now it's just like, I think it's out of control. And I think that the teachers union's leadership must also feel like it's a little bit out of control. I like how you say it's like they broke it, now they bought it, but it feels kind of out of control.
Well, you know, I think so. Part of the problem here is, you know, there's a healthy balance in any public debate, right? I mean, part of the American tradition is you want the isolationists and the interventionists to fight on foreign policy. And when it comes to something like education or social welfare policy, you want both kind of green eye shade conservatives. And part of, I think, what's been the challenge in education is conservatives have really suffered from a crisis of confidence over the last 20 or 30 years. One of the things that for me was striking about the bipartisan era, and Mike and I talk about this in the book, say during the Bush, Obama years, was how hesitant conservatives were to talk about the importance of parenthood. Conservatives stopped talking about two-parent families because, you know, in order to work together, we weren't gonna go there. At the very beginning of the No Child Left Behind negotiation, 60 days in, the Bush team gave up on school vouchers because we weren't going to go there. And it feels to me like a lot of the history of modern bipartisan education has been conservatives biting our tongue and being hesitant to speak up because we weren't really confident anyone would follow if we spoke and we didn't want to offend our allies. And what you've seen now in the last 4 or 5 years is craziness the other side on the right, where all of the response on culture is culture war. Chasing clicks, saying crazy things to get a reaction online. What we haven't seen much of is serious, principled, unafraid, courageous conservative leadership. I mean, 4 years ago, the KIPP charter schools announced they were abandoning their slogan of 25 years, work hard, be nice. They were abandoning work hard, be nice because they deemed it a legacy of white supremacy culture. I have yet to meet a normal human being, a normal parent of any race or background who doesn't want their kid to work hard and be nice. And yet, when I wrote about this, when Mike and I would talk about this, you could not find leaders in education, in the charter community. You couldn't even find Republican governors who would want to say that this was a problem because, you know, things are And I think part of the problem here is conservatives, not the crazy guys who are out chasing clicks and money online, very online, but serious conservatives need to talk about the things that we're for, and we need to call out as nonsense things that are nonsensical.
Yeah, I had Matt Malkus on the podcast talking about chronic absenteeism, and he is very clear. Like, we have got to step up and tell parents, you're responsible for some of these things. You cannot just hold the school system responsible for the well-being and how your child turns out. You are responsible. And I think even when he said it, it like resonated with me because I think we've all been kind of afraid to say it. Like, kids are not going to school. We've lost a bunch of kids. We don't even know where they are. And the ones we might know where they are, but they're missing more than 10% of the school year. We need to start holding parents account. Like, maybe not the way it was when I was a kid 100 years ago, with truant officers and whatnot, but we need to start saying to parents, you are part of this system here, and holding them a little bit more responsible. Would you say so?
Well, sure. I mean, what do we say? The first step of solving any problem is you got to admit that you have one in the first place, right? And I think it's important because the very first, you know, the introductory chapter to our book lays out these 8 conservative principles that we think should guide policy. And the very first one, and it's the first one for a reason, is that education is a handshake. So education is a handshake on the kind of micro level between the student and the teacher, and at a sort of larger level between the family and the school. And it's highlighting exactly what we're talking about here, that both sides of that equation need to be working. And as we talk about part of that kind of bipartisan era that we're talking about, there was a lot of comfort in talking about one side of that handshake, right? We want test-based teacher evaluation. We want school accountability. And again, done smartly and in a lot of these ways, we want, you know, teachers to be professionals. We want them to be trained well. We want them to use the best pedagogical resources and things that are there. All of that is true. We want to hold them accountable for their part of the handshake. At the same time, if we do that without mentioning the other side of the handshake, and then we're like shocked when teachers aren't excited when we talk about our plans that we have, we can't be. When teachers say that they feel scapegoated, when teachers feel like the deck is stacked against them, they kind of have a point, right? So right. Even if you're a person who wants to see more accountability, who wants to see more teachers, who wants to see all of that stuff, saying, hey, listen, parents have to do their part as well. That's the way to get that done.
I do think, though, in the last 20 or 30 years, the schools just took over more and more. And even when my kids were in school a long time ago, they talked about parent involvement, but it was like, at the time, making copies and laminating. I mean, they didn't really want you coming in and saying, I don't know about this interactive math like I was, because I'm like, that's a terrible math curriculum that you have chosen here. That's not the parent involvement they wanted, right? They wanted me to just come and teach my son about red and black coins. And I was like, fine, I can do it. And so I think when most parents, you know, kind of got used to that system. And then now it's kind of hard to say, oh, we forgot to tell you, you're also very much responsible for what's happening, right? Because you kind of, it's like learned helplessness almost, right?
Well, I think one way to think about this is we went from a passive system. You know, when I've written before about when I used to train student teachers in the last century, you know, in Boston, it was no trick at all. You'd be talking about how the student teacher was doing, and the teacher would say, some 30-year veteran Boston public school teacher would say, well, you're not going to be able to teach those kids. That's not, because there was a notion that those kids weren't here to learn. And what happened was we were very comfortable once upon a time putting it all on the families. Yeah. It's about the kid. It's about the family. And the schools were blameless. And you're right that created a certain kind of, you know, show up, fundraise for the PTA, and then shut up.
Yeah.
And then what happened in the bipartisan era, like Mike said, what we got exactly right was we said schools and educators have to be responsible. And that was a wonderful thing. But instead of saying, and that needs to be part of an equilibrium, we went way too far the other way.
Yeah.
And so we wound up, we went from passive to passive aggressive. Now schools are like, well, if it's all on us, we're going to call all the shots. And don't tell us what to use and don't ask to see our curricula and just mind your own business.
So and that's how do we move out of that? Like, what's your prescription for that?
Well, I think what we need to go is from passive aggressive to, you know, what Mike and I want to see is a virtuous cycle. We're for parent rights. One way that you start to break this is parents absolutely should darn well be able to see what books are being read. They ought to absolutely have a say whether pornographic texts are in middle school libraries. They absolutely, but when we talk about parents' rights as like an end all and be all, that's nuts. Those parent rights have to be met with parent responsibilities. We need, and a lot of the parent responsibilities piece ought to be bully pulpit. A lot of parents don't realize how poisonous their kids' phones are for their kids. They don't understand how horrible it is to let a 12-year-old girl be text messaging with friends at 11 p.m. at night. They don't understand what bad stuff happens when kids go unsupervised on social media. So part of this is being real clear about providing guidelines to parents, about setting really clear expectations. Phones out of your kids' hands at 8 o'clock. They're be charging next to the parents' bed. Kids go to bed at this time. We got out of a lot of these habits, both because of the introduction of digital devices and then because of the pandemic. And part of what I think Nat Malkus is arguing so effectively is we need to really help parents, both by being clear and by being clear and forceful about it, about what it looks like to set your kids up to succeed. And because we're not just, in too many cases, we're just not doing that right now.
Right. You know, and one of the things that I think we highlight too, we use this image in the sort of family policy chapter, but it goes throughout the book, this idea of enmeshing children in webs of support. I think one of the things that the pandemic brought clear to us, you know, when we saw, wow, if the school is the place where the child is fed, where they are educated, in some cases, like where they get their healthcare, that is one failure point, right? Like if that place closes down because there's a pandemic, now kids are going hungry, they're not getting their eyes checked, any of that sort of stuff. And I think it's a deeply kind of conservative insight to say, no, we have this thing called the civil society. And ideally, we would like children and by extension, their parents to show up in multiple kind of concentric circles. And look, traditionally, these are things like faith communities. These are extended families. These are, local t-ball leagues or whatever. Gyms, pick your poison on any of these things. But ideally, we want to think about, and again, part of this is about policy, but a lot of this is actually on the more cultural side. Making our own investments of our time, our talent, our treasure in trying to support the types of institutions that enmesh people in these webs of support. And then when these families are part of these communities and they're part of these school communities as well, to me, it makes it more likely that they will be invested, that they will be supported. They're not just going to be out on an island on their own.
So one area that I think is pretty sticky also these days is early childhood. There is an assumption that the government, usually state level, should provide universal pre-K for every 2, 3, 4-year-old, and they need to do it now. They need to do it yesterday. What is part of your conservative vision for early childhood?
Well, I mean, the big thing that we're thinking about here is we set aside these sort of principles. So what does early childhood education look like from a conservative, perspective? And the first one is that like the goals that it's trying to pursue, the ends. One is providing affordable, low cost childcare for working families. Like that's like number one. People are working, their children need a place to go while that's happening. And we would like to see that happen without cost ballooning and all of that. And we can talk about sort of ways to do that. The second one though is keeping children connected to their families. You know, again, as we talked about in the beginning, central conservative insight, family should be put first. There are all sorts of ways in which, we use fancy terms of art like family, friend, and neighbor care. But there's like all of the informal ways in which children have been reared for hundreds and thousands of years that people use now and people love now. And there are folks that are trying to support that, and that's there. And then the third one is that it needs to leverage the civil society, right? So a lot of what we see in, maybe our friends on the left, when they talk about early childhood education, essentially, this is like the Bill de Blasio model in New York, essentially, they're just saying, tack another grade or two onto K-12 schools, right? Put your kid on a bus. I mean, I couldn't imagine, but 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds on a bus, sure. Put them in a massive school with hundreds of other kids, some of them quite older than them. Seems like a nightmare scenario, but that seems to be what people are going for. And the union seemed kind of stoked about it. So that's on them. But I think where we would come, we would see methods and ways to try and support families, families who can't afford childcare, families who can't afford early childhood education. But we're much more likely to say, how can we create flexible funding structures? How can we create structures that can be used in more informal settings, or can obviously definitely be used if they're more formal, but they may be private settings? But that's the sort of the North Star that we want to have. We want to sort of make sure that the cost curve doesn't go crazy, that it does provide the care that people need, but it keeps children connected to their families, and it leverages the civil society.
It's really interesting, some of the research that's come out on the first model that you talked about, where you tack the grades on, when you go backwards to pre-K, that it damages children academically. Right. And I think at least one idea that's been thrown out there, which makes sense to me, is they end up standing in line most of the day because they're in a big school building.
Right.
And so they're like 4-year-olds and like to go to the bathroom, to go to the lunchroom, to go to the gym, you know, versus being in a daycare setting where that's all that's going on. But if you're in the school with up to the fifth grade, then these little 4-year-olds end up standing in line in the hallway a lot. And maybe that's why, but it does not seem to be a very strong approach to help kids who come to school behind. It has not seemed to bear out, but that's for another day.
Yeah. Oh. No, I mean, I think one of the nice things about tackling early childhood, again, I mean,
yeah.
Mostly for the last 20 years, if you ask folks on the right, well, what should we do in early childhood? You've gotten a giant sucking sound.
That's right.
Nothing there, which is crazy because, right, the problem with what Mike talked about, right, the de Blasio model in New York City, the $300 billion for early childhood and Build Back Better, right, when progressives, bless their hearts, try to tackle early childhood, they tend to tackle it as a matter of big policy solutions. Okay, well, that's where they're coming from. The problem is when you start talking about 3- and 4-year-olds, most parents are justifiably nervous as hell about that approach. What do you want with your 3- and 4-year-olds? You want them on a calendar that matches the parents' work calendar because you're not sending them off to summer camp. So having 10 weeks of no school isn't always great for all families with 9-year-olds, but it can be a nightmare with 3-year-olds. When you have them on a school calendar, the school's like, okay, we're done at 2:00. We're sending them home. Even if you're working the swing shift from 12 to 8, you're on your own. It's a third point in the morning. So instead of families being able to take their kids somewhere close by work, they put them on a bus or have to take them to a school building. And then if the kid's sick or if something comes up, a parent has to leave. I mean, this is a terrible scenario for huge numbers of parents.
Yeah.
What works better? Something where it's not part of an institutionalized school system, but you've got co-ops or employer-based care or proximate care that actually matches parents' work schedules. You can be more flexible in early childhood since you're not doing instructional scope and sequence. It's possible for kids to drop in and drop out on irregular parent. So, I mean, part of the crazy thing here is that conservatives and state legislatures have been playing me too with plans that are all about one size fits all bureaucratic expansion when there's actually much more attractive, much more sensible ways to try to tackle these same problems.
So like vouchers for parents, is that what you're saying? Like directly fund parents to find the right
flexible spending accounts. In Virginia, for instance, they just rolled out a plan a couple months ago trying to introduce a parent navigator that piggybacks on what we've seen in the K-12 space, where you've got something like an ESA analog where parents are able, where parents get more freedom of choice. Where employers have tax incentives to provide these things, where it gets treated more like healthcare, so that employers actually have a reason to say, oh, this is appealing, where you're working with the higher ed system to repurpose space in places where it's not available. So, yeah, a choice system, but a choice system that's worried about making sure parents have good, plentiful, reliable local options, not one that kind of just says, hey, we hope things work out.
So what about K-12? Like, what are your 2 or 3 biggest points that we need to improve K-12 going forward?
Well, look, I mean, the big thing we bring up is we talk about, you know, the types of institutions that we want to see, the types of people we want to populate those institutions, and the ends that we want them to pursue. And obviously, you know, you and I, we've been talking K-12 stuff forever. So we can go down like some of the policy paths. But, you know, some of the things that I would just put out there that I think, you know, when we talk about the types of institutions, we want them to be more personal. We want them to be voluntary. We want them to be flexible, you know, for a lot of the same things that Rick was just talking about. Right. We want people to be connected to their families. We want them to find the, you know, get in where they fit in and be flexible around that. We spend a lot of time in this book talking about teachers. So we think teachers are super important. We want teachers who are going to be partners with families. We want them to take their job as formers. You know, a lot of this book is definitely influenced by thinkers like Yuval Levin, you know, his great work about sort of formative versus performative institutions, right? Like this is the core thing of education, is trying to form young people. So we need to have teachers that embody that, that see that as their charge. And we want them to be professionals. And we spend a lot of time talking about teacher pay and decisions that have been made around things like class size and bureaucratization and how that's eaten into teacher salaries. So I think we have a lot of stuff to talk about there. And then the last is the sort of like the ends that we want them to pursue. So, you know, we talk about things like attachment. We talk about discipline. We talk about substance. So we think that we want schools to be more rigorous, to deal with great books and great works of literature and great works of art. And I think another thing that we enter in here that, you know, is becoming an increasingly big topic is like school discipline. I think
it's huge.
Totally right. And tied in with a lot of the chronic absenteeism that's taking place. When
teacher
you talk
shortage,
to,
I mean,
yeah, when
I mean,
you talk to teachers now, at least I don't know if y'all have the same experiences that I do, but I would have the experience of teachers predominantly complaining about pay. Totally get it. Happened for a long time. Increasingly, that is taking a far second place to discipline. And
safety.
Just like things, their
safety.
Own safety and all of
they
this.
Don't
yeah. So, and I think, again, this is a place where conservatives have a really good and important things to say based in our worldview, based the way that we see the world. So it's something we could really start to partner with teachers and build back some of that relationship, because we believe that schools should be places that are marked by discipline. We believe that the children are capable of behaving themselves. They can. They totally can. And we should support the administrators and teachers that are helping them along that path.
So when you talk about the bipartisan era, can you define that? Like, when is the bipartisan era, the era that you're talking about?
I think, you know, in the book, we talk about it really starting kind of about 1990 with the Charlottesville summit of President Bush 41 and the governors, and really stretching to about the Common Core fights during the Obama years. So really from about 1990 to about 2010, 2012.
Yeah, because I feel like some of the things that you brought up, Mike, like the discipline issue, that got messed up during the Obama era, right? Like we really leaned in. Now we have enough years of data to know that it was kind of a fail. Teachers didn't feel safe. Schools weren't safe. A lot of the guidance coming out from the department kind of backfired. Some of the Title IX stuff kind of backfired, right? So I would like to think that we are in a place where we can see that and make better decisions going forward. But I guess Common Core kind of blew it up because the Obama administration so kind of like strong-armed states into adopting it.
I think Common Core was more, it was more a symptom than the disease. The tensions that you saw, the frustrations with kind of top-down technocracy. You saw those during the No Till Left Behind fights.
Yeah.
You saw them bubbling up in the fights about teacher evaluation. You saw resistance and annoyance both on the left, and then this stuff really got traction on the right. But look, I mean, by 2016, whereas, you know, President Bush, President Clinton, President Obama, both President Bushes, talked about education by tacking to the middle. By 2016, Hillary Clinton was done with that. She was talking about spending more. She was saying, you know, charter schools are bad. Donald Trump was done with attacking the middle. He was talking about vouchers and how horrible the Common Core was. So in some sense, you could think about the bipartisan tree was already on shaky ground, and Common Core was really more the hurricane that blew it down, rather than the source of all its problems.
Well, you know, we touched on this a little bit with like kind of the implosion at some of the Ivy League schools this year over a separate issue. But before that, like during the pandemic, and I think even slightly before that, higher ed enrollment has been going down, steadily going down, and then it started going down more sharply. It's affected by the economy, but I think the idea that a college education was air quotes worth it really has started to take a hit. And so for a lot of 18-year-olds who are like, ignoring the college loan thing that's happening right now, where maybe it's a big Christmas present, maybe it's not, I don't know. But it's just started to really feel not worth it because every college started charging $50,000 and it was hard to see like how what are we going to get for that? How do we like restore the reputation, I guess, of higher ed so that it really is kind of a game changer for your life outcomes. I know people
Totally.
don't want to believe that, but it really kind of is. College Board does an analysis of this every year, and it is, they used to call it the $1 million difference, but it really does impact your life. So as much as you would like to say, not everyone needs to go to college, of course they don't, but it really does. It shouldn't be thought of, I don't think, as negatively as it is now. How do we restore the reputation of going to college, making it seem worth it?
Totally. I think a first step, and maybe one that folks wouldn't think of right away, actually is outside of colleges. Colleges don't have anything to do with this, but part of it is around using a college degree as a hiring test. We talk about in the book, there's actually this fascinating history around why some jobs started to say you have to have a bachelor's degree in order to do that. Even jobs that anybody would look at and would say, that seems absurd. And a lot of it comes around bias in hiring tests. There was all sorts of Supreme Court litigation around tests that were done, and it got to like absolute silly season of how this was done. And so a lot of businesses just said, nope, we're not doing hiring tests anymore. But for reasons that are somewhat opaque, college degrees have never had the same scrutiny that other hiring tests have had, disparate impact and all of those things that people care about. So lots of businesses have been able to use it as a quote unquote unbiased way to determine people who are eligible to work there. And so for lots of young people, they have been kind of forced to go to college to then take a job that doesn't need a college degree. And I think that that just is such an insidious problem. And it you can imagine how that could affect other people on campus. If you've got people that are like, literally, I don't actually need to learn anything here. I have to have this piece of paper because the job says I have to get a piece of paper. And there are people that are taking steps against this. So I think Larry Hogan, when he was governor of Maryland, Josh Shapiro, the current governor of Pennsylvania, I think Josh Shapiro, on like his first day, he removed college degrees as an employment requirement for like tens of thousands of state jobs. And I think that's a step that we could do in the public sector. You know, the governor of Missouri or the governor of Kansas or anybody could tomorrow say, hey, look, we're getting rid of bachelor's degrees as this, so that the only reason you come to college now is because you want to be here, because you need to be here, because you want that to happen. I mean, I think that that's like, again, it has nothing to do with what college is doing. Obviously, we spend a lot of time in the book talking about ways that we can make college itself better. But that's a kind of external factor that sits out there that is worth thinking about.
I mean, we've invested colleges like writ large across the United States have invested so much in plant and equipment. I mean, like they are the buildings, the grounds, the recreational facilities compared to well, you live in Ireland. I was going to say to compared to other countries,
For
the United
sure.
States, we invest so heavily in the experience and the sort of look and feel of college, and that's gonna need to change, right? And under your scenario, only the people going are those that really want to learn the stuff. That's gonna be a lot fewer people.
It could be. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, like it could be as the world of work changes. And I think as institutions evolve to maybe think about, you know, some of the stuff we talk about in the book, there have been really innovative things around ideas of like 3-year degrees or other forms of sort of post-secondary preparation that are not necessarily 4-year degrees. So it could be that these institutions have more people going to them, but they're going episodically or they're going for shorter periods of time. So I think, you know, it's we are very clear in the book that, you know, because on the right now, especially post some of the hearings that we saw, there is a big, you know, nuke them from orbit, right? Yeah. Like yeah. The colleges are, they need to be pulled out root and branch. And, you know, I think, I don't know if we've said in the book or we said it on a panel recently, we talked about this. We see ourselves as custodians, not arsonists. Yeah. Right. We see our job necessary. You got to clean things up. And sometimes when you're the custodian, you need to rip out stuff that's not working anymore. But you're doing that to preserve the building, to fix it, to make it better. And I think that, you know, a lot of these institutions are really proud and important, like the University of Missouri. If you think about that, like all the land grant universities were a really important part of American history and led to so many great things. And you can't just. You can't have a new 150-year-old institution, right? And so there's a certain part of the sort of conservative sentiment that says, you know, we should respect things and we should try to, you know, be custodians to the things that have been given to us. And so I think that's the way we need to approach it, is thinking about these institutions as custodians, taking out the things that don't need to be there anymore, cleaning up the bits that are dirty, and leaving them better for the people that come after us.
So are you optimistic about where we're heading, like for the full spectrum of education, pre-K to post-secondary? Are you optimistic about where the United States is heading on all of these?
So like, I am by nature an optimist. Yes. So these are not necessarily like, great questions for me.
I've never really heard you say no.
Yeah, I'm not optimistic. Like, I'm kind of optimistic. But I will tell you, look, I think on obviously K-12, the incredible growth that's been happening in school choice programs, I think a lot of the stuff that's happening is really a good sign and the opportunity to build new great institutions. I think, frankly, on higher education, you know, a lot of the stuff that happened recently, I don't know if it's going to be like Common Core-like in the sense that it's like the straw that breaks the camel's back, but seeing donors and, you know, administrators and others saying, okay, we have serious problems here and we need to do something about it. You know, when folks are withholding donations and they're saying you need to change, or we're saying, where else can we give this money? Let's build some new institutions or others. Yeah. So if I think if we see in higher education, what we're kind of seeing in K-12, like a serious commitment to build new great institutions, and there's money behind it and there's support behind it. And some of these things are happening. There's the University of Austin and Minerva, and there are some of these centers that are being built at the University of Florida and Arizona State. Yeah. And Purdue, all of those great things that are doing. Yeah. So these things, if we see over the course of the next 5 or 10 years, those kind of sprout up like mushrooms all over the place, then I think we're really on a much more positive trajectory.
I do think K-12 is at a point of inflection, because I think that the coalition around school choice issues, I mean, on that one in particular, just grew during the pandemic. And now that it's grown, there's just, I mean, I know you're exactly right. It's always polled at 70%, all different forms of it, going back 20 years, 2/3 of or so, give or take, have always said, yeah, parents should be able to choose where their kids go to school. 2/3 have said, sure, I'd like a charter school in my neighborhood. That's very consistent. It's just shocking that it hasn't become more widespread until now. And now I think it is. But now I think, you know, you have districts, a fairly large district in Missouri, independent, saying, oh, by the way, heads up, from now on, school's going to be in session 4 days a week instead of five. And just like,
I saw that.
Boom, drop it on parents. You know, they claim to have surveyed them, but most of parents are not happy, but just boom, drop it. And just think that they will follow.
You know, right? What I mean?
Just think you could just do that and people are just going to buckle, I guess. And there's pushback happening on that one. There's just building this coalition of like, I want school choice because I don't like where my kids are. Sure. I just don't like it. They didn't like, or, you know, it could have been masked vaccines, could have been in curriculum. So many things that have come up in the last 3 or 4 years, but now you have people who never thought about it before, or who thought it was just, you know, an escape hatch for kids in urban districts to get out vouchers in Milwaukee, of course. Right. So just an escape hatch. Now people are like, yeah, you know, screw that. I'm not going to let my district all of a sudden knock 20% off the school week and just go along with it. So I'm optimistic that we're seeing a bit of an institutional level change that has been, you know, a long time coming. And I think, in my opinion, will make the system better. You know, I think it'll make all the schools at some point better to be forced into being more responsive.
For sure. Agreed.
Yeah. And maybe like to what we've talked about before, we can get to a more pluralist system of schools where they don't all look exactly alike and they don't all do everything for every student. So I think that that's good too. Well, I do want to like say that I like that you put conservative in the title. I think that's the way to go. I do think we give up too much ground, and I do think that this is a good moment for it, because this is when sort of like our friends on the left have kind of, I don't like this term, but gotten out over their skis or whatever. So I think it's time to bring some smart ideas, and I think and give at least a roadmap to where to go at state level and the federal level. So thanks for writing it, and I really enjoyed reading it.
Thank you so much.